Welcome to the Cop Doc Podcast. This podcast explores police leadership issues and innovative ideas. The Cop Doc shares thoughts and ideas as he talks with leaders in policing, communities, academia, and other government agencies. And now, please join Dr. Steve Morreale and industry thought leaders as they share their insights and experience on the Cop Doc Podcast.
Well, hello, everybody. This is Steve Morreale coming back at you for another episode of the Cop Doc Podcast. And today we are staying local. Right near my backyard, we have Ed Cronin, former chief in Fitchburg and Gardner, and traveled abroad to help foreign police agencies. So good morning, Ed. Thank you for joining. I want to start by having people understand what your background is. And obviously, right from the get-go, I want to talk about your book, Just Policing, My Journey to Police Reform. So tell us about how long you were at the job of policing, where you started, how you moved around, and what are you doing now?
Sure. I guess the elevator speech portion of it would be, I started out as a police officer in Fitchburg. And from the very beginning, I knew that when I was in the academy, a lot of the things that I was learning didn't strike me as, well, let's use the word just at this point. You know, the domestic violence laws weren't passed in those days, and the man could beat the snot out of his wife. He'd basically tell you to get out of his house. And so there were things like that in the beginning. And anyway, I took on the role. I loved the role. I was very, very active as a young police officer. And I think one of the big turning points for me was education. At the time, Massachusetts had passed a law for what they called the Quinn Bill, which was incentive money to get degrees. Unfortunately, when that program first came out, there were many institutions offering the degrees of very, very poor quality. And matter of fact, the Boston Globe did a big thing on it, and it really exposed a lot of scams and cheating that were going on. Mm-hmm. So when I decided to go for my bachelor's degree, I decided to go to the University of Louisville at the time. And that was a tough thing to do. I was a young cop. I had a family. I had to travel 30 miles each way, sometimes five times a week while working full times and my overtime. But I had quality instructors. I had Dr. Larry Siegel, who's retired now. He is
the writer. He's an author. I know Larry very well. Yeah.
Well, I had him as a teacher, and I was just told recently that his 1 millionth textbook has been published. Mm-hmm. Okay. I had Dr. E. Bazawa, mm-hmm. who's a national expert on domestic violence, yep. and Dr. Harold Hatalik, who actually got me to understand what quantitative methods actually were. So what I'm trying to say is I got a really great education there. And on top of it, the tipping point was when I was in my master's program, I was offered a month in August to go to Oxford University in England mm-hmm. as take a couple of courses on the British criminal justice system. And that's when everything changed. That's when I worked with a young police officer my age from the Thames Valley Police. And I got to understand and listen to how they did policing over there. And fundamentally, I'm an evidence-based person when I'm evaluating anything. And when you look at the evidence of how their policing functions in terms of the lack of violent crime compared to what we have in this country, it's not even an argument. So I came away with some very different ideas. The next thing that happened while I was there, there was a police officer from Medford. And this was right around the time the wall went down in the Soviet Union. And he wanted to go to Eastern Europe in the worst way. And he talked me into joining with a nonprofit and bringing the first American police officers to Russia in 1993. And it got bigger than us. You know, CBS went with us on the trip. It was on national television, the whole nine yards. And then before you know it, the Russians sent a delegation to visit us. We did homestays. We took them to Washington, D.C. Louis Freed, the director, met us, spoke with us, and we're walking out of his office and the State Department standing in the hallway and they want to fund this program.
Mm, that's big.
So everything just kind of took on a life of its own.
Mm-hmm. Let me stop. Just want to explain for the listeners. You were a police officer in Fitchburg. You went to Gardner as the chief. You came back to Fitchburg, which you haven't even said yet. But I want to go back to the Quinn Bill and the fact that you went to Oxford. And I think the experiences certainly that I've had in Europe with policing, it's completely different. And while they may be behind some of the things we've done in the U.S. technologically, I think they're way ahead in many cases. Not that they're not running into their own problems about relationships with community, but in many cases, they're fairly well accepted. And they're not just driving from place to place. They're getting to know the people they police, which I think is an important element of policing. And I'm sure you're going to talk about that. But going back to the Quinn bill, I understand, and I've done a lot of writing, and it still troubles me to this day, the way the Quinn bill diluted many of the programs that were run. Again, for the listener, I think the Globe Spotlight really cast a very poor shadow on policing, because the issue was, let's let police go to school, we'll bring the training to them or the education to them. There doesn't have to be a lot of writing. Sometimes you don't have to show up. There is no serious assignments granted. And I taught for some of them at that point in time, and I stopped doing it because the mindset of so many police officers, and it's pretty incredible to hear that, was when you'd ask, why are you taking the class? What is this important to you? I'm doing it for my incentive, for the money, not for the learning, but for the incentive. So you've got a lot going for you to have done what you did and went to a school where that was not an issue, where learning was the most important, not getting the degree or getting the credit so that you could get the money and then go back to doing whatever. So I understand. And I know you worked with many police officers who had that mindset, and I'm sure you worked pretty hard to try to change that mindset to say, no, learning can be so valuable to you. It can open your mind. Does that, in a nutshell, talk about why you didn't go to some schools and you chose to go to Lowell?
Well, you absolutely just read my mind. That's exactly how I felt. And to this day, I'm on the UMass Lowell Alumni Board, and I've been president of the Criminal Justice Alumni Board. And I do everything in my power to promote that program even today.
That's great. Let's talk about your rise and your leaving the police department to go to another department. You went to Gardner at some point. Is that right?
Correct. It's funny because it's connected to the Russian program. I became a sergeant in Fitchburg. I was in Fitchburg the first time around 15 years. In the last 6 years I was there, I was a sergeant. And I was a sergeant in the detective bureau, worked in patrol, and I was a good investigator. But I really felt like I had kind of maxed out my capability to go forward anymore because it was a civil service system. And that was based on an examination. I had no problems with examinations, but some people were promoted that shouldn't be promoted because they got a high score on a test, but didn't really know how to be a supervisor. So anyway, when I was jumping back to when I was in Russia, I didn't go looking for a leadership role. But before you know it, I was on national TV in Russia on a regular basis. I was being interviewed. I was a de facto representative of our country. I didn't even ask for it. But there were people that were constantly wanted to interview me. They wanted to take statements. Before you know it, I was on a plane going to the State Department once or twice a month, giving a reporting out on what was going on. So a lot of my leadership came about to that work that I did on that program. And then one day when I was back in the States, I told my wife, I says, I'm going to throw a resume in for this job in Gardner. And I remember her telling me, I was in the car with some friends and she was there and she said, why did you say that? You're not going to get that job. And I said, I just want to try. So I threw my resume in at the last minute. They interviewed me. I nailed the interview. I knew I did really well. And I remember standing up and saying, thank you very much for an opportunity to stretch myself professionally. And I walked out and I felt like, wow, that was fun. And I got home, the phone rang and they said, they want you. And I'm like, no. I says, when do you need to know by? And they said, now. And I said, well, give me 24 hours. And they did. And then I decided to take it. And the reason I took it, I have a brother who's passed now, but he was kind of my hero. And I called him. He was a bank president. And I said, Mike, what do you think of this offer? I says, I'm not experienced in administration and stuff. And he said, Eddie, that's going to create so many open doors for you. Do it. Mm-hmm. And that's how it started. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about a couple of things. Again, to put it in the minds of those who are listening, who are not from New England, your two police departments that you worked with were in central Massachusetts, headed out west. And tell us about the size at the time of the Gardner Police versus the Fitchburg Police, some of the demographics of those two city and towns.
Fitchburg was growing more and more multiculturally. So going to Gardner was like going to Mayberry. It's like 20,000 people. it was primarily white. And that kind of led into what was my mandate going to be when I was a police chief in Gardner.
I'm just kind of thumbing through the book. At one point in time, you wrote a book, Just Policing, and I thank you for sending a copy. I also want to say that going abroad as you have, and I've spent time in Russia, which was mind-boggling for me, especially having been in the Army, and remember going to the Czech border at the time and all of them saying, don't go near there, that's where the Reds are. And certainly there's a whole different view of Russia now because of what's going on in Ukraine. You worked in Ukraine, and it must really pain you to think about what they're going through, because once you get to know people, whether it's in Russia or in the Ukraine, there are still amazing people in both countries. It's crazy because I do believe, as I travel all over the world, as you have traveled over the world, policing is policing. We have democratic policing, I understand. Many countries did not, but it doesn't mean their job wasn't risky, their job wasn't difficult. I'm sure you and your colleagues were trying to do is to bring to them a different point of view of what policing could be. And I think that's an interest. I see you shaking your head an awful lot. So those experiences, they must have been life-changing for you.
Yeah, they definitely were. The first group that I took over there, we had quite a few veterans, Americans. There was 25 of us. Mm-hmm. And I detail in the book when the plane landed what we saw. We landed in Karelia. The runway had ruts in it. Over to the right, we were slowing down, and I could see a couple of MiG fighters in pieces. It looked like a junkyard. Get off the plane, and they send a bus to pick us up that must have been from World War II with big holes in it.
So old, I know.
And big black smoke bellowing out. And I remember a couple of the veterans behind me saying, this is what we were afraid of. They couldn't get out of their own way. But anyway, what you said about what's going on in the world today, yeah, it breaks my heart. But there was a window at that time when we went there. There was a good feeling that things could be different. But then our friend Putin got in and it
changed for sure. Let's focus in on policing today. What you're seeing, what you're watching, what you're hearing, what needs to happen. Certainly, the more I read, and I know you keep up on things where they're saying they're having so much difficulty recruiting, retaining. I was just in New York Police Department when I would talk to any. I'm not afraid to walk up to anybody in uniform. It's just in our blood. And when you talk to people, I said, how long have you been on? 8 years, 17 to go. Can't wait. 17-year countdown, if you can imagine. And that they feel beleaguered. They feel put upon. They feel disrespected. They feel threatened. And I'm not saying that some of that isn't earned. By the same token, we know most police officers are well-meaning and are not going out to kick someone's ass every single day or to shoot somebody every single day. It may be the last thing. But you start talking about interesting what you was saying about the academy and the academy then and the academy now, what it should be, preparing leaders, preparing. Look, Ed, as a chief of police, I know you realized that 90% of the work, and maybe that number is low, is not arresting people. Correct. It is about interacting with people, creating relationships, helping them, trying to identify problems, being proactive. Talk about that.
Yeah, there's a misconception with a lot of people when they go into policing that somehow, and I remember being in Fitchburg, and I had the officers that worked for me that were always looking for the big score, the big takedown, the big shootout, or whatever it was, the big medal, the whole thing. And like you just said, that's so infinitesimal. It really ever happens. But what's really going on is your ability to get along with people. And there's a great little story in my book, and I'll take a 5-second break to tell it. There was an officer that worked with, his name was Joel Caddy. He's still around. He was a great guy, and he worked in a poor neighborhood. And frankly, he was loved by the people in that neighborhood. And he spent a lot of time with the people. He became very close friends with a Black woman who was an elderly woman. She was the matriarch of the neighborhood. And they became very good friends. And he would stop and talk with them and the family. And then one day, the neighborhood got hit by a series of armed robberies. And they had a fuzzy videotape, and Joel looked at it at one of the stores, and he says, I think that's so-and-so. So he takes the thing, the tape, the VCR. This is back in the old days.
Yeah.
Tape, brings it to the mother, shows it to her. And the mother says, that's my boy. She recognized the kid on the tape. So Joel says to her, look, tell so-and-so, no one's going to hurt him. Tell him to turn himself in. He's going to get killed or he's going to kill somebody else. The mother took care of it. She did it. He turned himself in.
Mm-hmm. Her own son. Yeah,
her own son. Mm. He told me that one of the things he used to do was he'd get off duty at 11 and he'd go see this woman. He'd pick up a 6-pack of beer and tomato juice, and they'd have red eyes together at night before he went home. So you see what I'm saying?
I do.
He was human. He used to tell me, Ed, I never took 2 weeks vacation in a row. I says, why? He says, I was afraid somebody would screw up my neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, he was such a valuable asset. And then when we'd have serious crimes go on, you don't solve everything, but sometimes something big happens and you got to have somebody out there. That's
you got to go to ground and see who's got their ear and their finger on the pulse. You know, what can you tell me, Louise? But you can't do it if you don't. You know, that's an interesting piece because this is one of the things I'm sure you've talked about and I've talked about. The time to have a relationship with a neighborhood, with the editor of the paper, with the person responsible for the fire department or DPW is not during crisis. It's well before. So talk about that.
I think here's an excellent example of that. We've all seen what's happened in the last few years with Ferguson, all these other areas where we've had these incidences that have happened. And even to this day, I'm not going to judge who was indicted, who wasn't indicted, whether it was right, wrong, racist, or anything else. Okay. Here's the point that I make. When I was a police chief, we had a very, very strong relationship with our minority community, and we developed it through a lot of footwork, being on the ground, spending hours and hours in meetings, offsite. Sometimes I have leaders in my car and chatting and blah, blah, blah. So one day towards last year when I was there, unfortunately, the state police chased a young black kid into my city. They got one of my officers to help him out. My officer blocked this kid's car, pulled him over. The state trooper got out of his car. The kid panicked. He drove towards my officer and the state trooper shot him and killed him. All right. Mm-hmm. Why didn't Fitchburg burn to the ground? I'll tell you why. There's a concept. If you're familiar with Stephen Covey.
I am.
The Seven Habits. Well, one of the things he calls is the emotional bank account. We had a strong relationship with our minority community. I got a call from one of the black advocates in the morning when that came in. He didn't say, good morning, chief. He said, what happened? And I said, this is exactly what happened as I know it. And I told him, and I said, none of this, I'm not talking, you know, because of the DA and all that. No, this is my city. These are my people. I told him exactly what happened. And he said to me, if you said it, I believe it.
Yeah, yeah. So earned trust.
Right. We had 2 or 3 days of protests. Mm-hmm. And we also had one advocate come out and thank the police for their transparency. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's the difference to me. Mm-hmm. It's the work you put in.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Ed Cronin, former chief at Fitchburg, Massachusetts, and Gardner, Massachusetts Police Department, and having done an awful lot of work in Europe and Russia. And I want to get to a conversation. So much of this is about leadership and so many things. And I will tell you, one of the things that frustrates me is when all of the things happen with George Floyd and the protests that happened and January 6th and the shootings that continue to occur, that so many police chiefs remain silent and on the sidelines. They say nothing. And I understand the cancel culture worries them, but I think that that's the time that you should be saying, what you saw in Minneapolis, we hope never happens here, but here's what we're doing to try to reduce that from happening. And it seems to me that's a message that needs to come out, and I'm not sure why those things don't happen more often.
That's a great observation, and I agree with it 110%. As leaders, it's up to us to make that move. A friend explained to me a little concept about leadership one time. The root of the word leader comes in the word Lee, which has a root of Indian and European roots. And the word Lee, in its ancient interpretation, literally means a threshold, and literally means a threshold of a door. And what a leader does is they step over the threshold. And that's the difference between leadership and administration to me. I've just read Bill Bratton's book, mm-hmm. and Bill came right out and said, do Black lives matter? Of course they matter. And don't play this, I matter, you matter, they matter, police matter. Don't play that game. You just seen somebody murdered. Just the idea of being present and showing some compassion is going to make a huge difference. And you know, during that time period, they had protests in Fitchburg. They had a big march here. They had helicopters overhead, the whole nine yards, no violence.
Yeah.
So again, that bank account paid off. Mm-hmm.
So once again, we're talking to Ed Cronin, and we're talking about him taking over, first being a sergeant, and then taking over a smaller town, Gardner, Massachusetts. And Ed, you and I have worked for people who are autocratic, are old-fashioned, are top-down thinking, think they know it all, don't want to be challenged, basically bark out edicts, and you're supposed to run and do what you're told. So I liken leadership in policing more like coaching and mentoring and developing others and calling on the people who are working for them to come up or help with ideas about how to improve a particular situation. So let's talk about you walking into a new police department with people you don't necessarily know. What was different in your approach?
The first thing I had to do was I had to take over from a highly successful police chief. Mm-hmm. His name was Ralph Evangelist.
Ralph. Yeah.
Ralph went to Texas and then he got, I don't know if he's still in Wilmington, but highly successful. I mean, he was loved by the officers there. And so I had big shoes to fill. So, and that's fine. And I got in the door. And one of the reasons I left Fitchburg was because community policing had been rolling out at the time when I was in Fitchburg. And at that time, the chief who we had, who I greatly respect, even though I didn't agree with, he said, they sent me and another sergeant to a federal seminar to learn about community policing. John and I went to it. We got very excited when we learned about community policing and different things, empowerment and all this other stuff. And John went back to the chief and he says, you're never going to see that here well, as long as I live. So that was one of my incentives to go.
Wait a minute. The chief said that.
Yes. Yeah. You know, it is what it is. Mm-hmm. So I ended up in Gardner and Ralph was a community police officer. I had an open door in terms of how to go about my business. So I got myself out in the community like I did later in Fitchburg. I joined task force to see what was going on in my city. And one of the things was remarkable that came out was a study put on by the health community. They identified the number one cause of women going to the emergency room in the north central region of the state was domestic violence. So I had a mandate and I put together a fairly innovative program along with a grant writer who helped me do it, where we did a community thing of approaching domestic violence on several different levels. You know, we brought in the advocate, we did this programs in the schools on domestic violence. My offices would train with emergency room nurses, which was a new thing. And because if you've been in policing, you know, the emergency room is that's the place where it's happening. And you need to have those relationships.
Yes, you do.
Mm-hmm. And the program became, we applied for this grant, was highly competitive from the federal government. We got it. And it was very effective. We put it out there. And that actually was the basis of how I ended up leaving and going to Russia. I ended up taking that program that I had in Gardner, did some tweaking to it, and we used it all over Russia from Siberia down to the Black Sea.
That amazing.
Same program. Yeah.
These are the things and the innovative approaches. I think what you did was you're looking at what are the issues? What needs attention? How can we play a role realizing? I think this is an important question. And that is for those chiefs, and I'm not saying that most chiefs don't already know that, but for those chiefs who think that policing have the answer to all of the problems, I think that's shallow thinking because in many cases, you can't do it without partners. So I want to ask that question. How did you ask your people to go out and find the proper partners so that we can work on these problems collectively together?
That's a great question. And it takes me to my time in Fitchburg when we had all these murders that were going on in the Latino community. We were crime murder city when I first took over. Mm-hmm. And I remember going to my command staff and saying, who do we talk to in this community? And one of them came in with a big file about 12 inches high of folders with lawsuits from the Latino community. He says, this is how we communicate with them. All right. There were no things. So when you say, how did you do that? I did it by going out myself. I started by going to murder scenes. I started by talking with families. I started by meeting with people and getting and listening to their stories. Okay. I had to create that line of communication. It didn't exist.
Well, by you showing up, I've spoken to so many, even on major police departments, where so many police departments came so callous that repeat issues would occur and none of the top brass would show up, that they would yield to a captain or they would yield to a lieutenant and the deputy chief wouldn't go out because it happened so often. And a dear friend of mine in LA started showing up at those scenes and said, when those serious shootings happen, I want to be notified and I want to show up. And when he would show up, he'd say, where is the captain? Don't know. Call him and tell him I'm here. And that changed the dynamic immediately. So you have to put yourself out there exactly what you said. Did you have to do that as the chief? No. You did not have to, but you chose to. Isn't that true? You could sit and get the report on the phone, but instead going, seeing firsthand and talking, did that change your own perspective?
Well, yeah, absolutely. The first chapter of the book talks about the Christmas Eve murders.
Yes.
And seeing the impact and the way the whole thing was handled was eye-opening. What happens is, like you said, these officers are great people. You got a couple bad apples, a few here and there, but they want to do the right thing. And when I was in the police station that Christmas Eve, I was watching officers working their butts off, doing things to the T. But what was missing, and this is a leadership issue, was we had lost the focus of what this was doing to our community. Great at processing, but we weren't solving anything in the long run. So that's when you have to look at it different.
So Ed, I see behind you, I have the ability to see you on this video conference, even though this is an audio only podcast, and I see your bookshelf. Tell us, turn around and tell me what's on your book. What have you read? What kinds of things help you draw inspiration?
That's a great question. I have an advanced graduate degree from Suffolk University in organizational development and change. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the books here in systems thinking, which is a whole nother chapter in my book. But and I'm also a certified coach. I do coaching and leadership. Mm-hmm. And this book called The Fifth Discipline by Peter Senge.
Yes. It's an oldie but goodie, isn't it?
Yeah. Peter caught me and let me go to a conference up in Vermont. I think it was like a $5,000 conference with the executives while I was police chief.
Yep.
And I got a chance to work with some pretty good people to get ideas that I could bring back to policing.
Right. So let me ask you about this. I want you to continue, but I think what you're just saying now is so important for other people to think, to expand your horizons, to expand your mindset. I think police chiefs and those who are interested in leading in policing have to stop reading police only literature, right? Right. I think that's so important. Listen, I remember
O.W. Wilson had his day.
Oh my God. Well, how about Iannone? It's on his 75th. He's dead 20 years. It's still being written. It's crazy, crazy stuff. So, you know, it seems to me, and that's what I think higher education does for so many people, and that is to give them the opportunity to look much more broadly and look at literature from other places, from business and from healthcare and from marketing and such. And I see you smile, but talk about that. What does that conjure in your mind?
You know, I guess I'm a learning junkie. Mm-hmm. Once you start learning, you want to learn more and more. Mm-hmm. Like when I was talking about working with Peter Senge and coming up with ideas of systems analysis when looking at problems and all this stuff. Well, that leads to another conference I went to. I'm a police chief and I'm going up to a conference on the functioning of the brain.
Well, okay? I've been to so many myself where I was the only law enforcement official among all other people. And they're looking at you like, what are you doing here? Isn't that true?
Hey. Right. Well, you know, one of the things I learned right off the bat was there's some professor up there explaining that the human brain doesn't mature till you're 26 years old. All right. And the frontal lobal part is reasoning. That's last. And here we are recruiting kids at 19 and giving them firearms. I know this by just talking to you. You know, that's such a bomb to put on the table that 99% of people in our industry will walk away from that and won't even talk about it. Mm-hmm. But if you're putting somebody in Afghanistan and you want them to take that hill and they're 18 years old, okay, that's one thing. But that's not what we do.
So back to your bookshelf and leading into your book, because I think that's important to talk about. I just started an outline for a book on leadership. There's 1,000 books on leadership, but I do so much training. I'm thinking, you know, I want to memorialize some of these things. And I think it's for a wider audience, as I'm sure you did. But let's go to the book. So you wrote a book, Just Policing, Your Journey. It's called My Journey to Police Reform. And you wrote it with Danya Kendall. So talk about this process and why you did it and what the outcome of it has been.
I actually had been thinking about it for a number of years. And I had a couple of false starts, actually. I get out 2 or 3 chapters and get off to the side and I don't do it anymore. And then after George Floyd happened, that kind of re-motivated me a little bit. And to make a long story short, my co-author is a very accomplished English teacher, administrator, and practitioner of restorative practices, okay, which is I talk about in the book too. And she didn't add per se any of the content of the book, but she was the person who motivated me and edited for me to get this done. And she's also a local person, and she was very, very familiar with a lot of the situations and people I had to deal with. So she was a miracle that came into my life. And we worked together on this for like 9 months, and then boom, all of a sudden it's happened.
Yeah, it's a lot. All right, we're talking again with Ed Cronin, former chief, Fitchburg, Massachusetts, and Gardner, Massachusetts police, and international teacher of policing. And he wrote a book, Just Policing, My Journey to Police Reform, with Dana Kendall. And we were just talking about that. We've also talked about his trajectory, his approach, the changes in policing over time. We've talked a little bit about what's on his bookshelf. We're coming to the end of the episode, but I want to continue the conversation on developing others, because I think one of the things, as I'm writing and as I'm teaching, I'm saying to young people who are sergeants and lieutenants and captains and have some desire to move forward, that when you rise up, yes, you're responsible for other people, but it isn't about you. It's about them. So talk about that.
That's the fire that keeps my engine burning. Mm-hmm. Through the whole period of my career, I'd say the greatest satisfaction I've got in all the work that I've ever done is empowering other people. And it's a hard concept sometimes with cops, that when you give, you get back so much. And sometimes there's a feeling of, a lot of people get into this, what are you going to do for me type thing. And when you do that, you restrict yourself badly. What I would always try to do is try to find, look for talent and promote it. There isn't anything more rewarding than seeing people rise above.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me that having a conversation with people and giving them hope and commenting, I remember having a student, and I'm not equating a student to a police officer, but this is probably a future police officer. And I called him up one day and I said to him, hang on a second, I want to talk to you. And I kind of put him in a corner, and I was playing with him. I knew he could handle it, but I said, you, and I pointed at him. I think he was stunned. And I paused just to watch his reaction. And I said, you have promise.
Is so important what you did. Someone did that to me, yeah. A professor too.
Mm-hmm. So I think it is about identifying talent and pushing people beyond what they believe is their capability or their limits, and helping them understand. I think this is really important, Ed. Sometimes having a conversation with somebody who is on the job to say, I don't know what's been going on in your life and I don't want to interfere, but you had such a different view a few years ago and you seem to have lost your way. How can I help you get back there? Because you've got such promise. And have you tried this, pushing people to education, to higher education, that kind of thing? It's really very important sometimes. And people will give you all kinds of excuses why they can't do it, but the value of it. And I think one way to sell it is, why do you stay? Why did you stay in policing when you could have walked away? So tell me what you say to people now who are interested in policing, but in these times.
I look at it from point of view of, this is a time of opportunity. Yeah, there is a lot of pressure out there and a lot of undue criticism towards police right now, but it's an opportunity. It's an opportunity to do things differently. And, you know, just as a quick little example, one of the things that I kind of came to for a conclusion was, you know, we need to revamp our training for police officers today. I came up with an idea when I was writing the book about, we have 20 weeks of police academy. Why don't we take a month, take the person out of the academy, put them in a neighborhood that's suffering, go work with an agency and give them a project for a month to work with people that are living on the edge all the time, and get a chance to see what the job is really like, not John Wayne. Didn't I read Bratton's book? And Bratton's already done that.
Yes.
And as a matter of fact, he does it with his senior officers too. He makes them go back into the neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. So I think redoing the whole idea of what a police officer does in terms of the training that we do, I think could be really, really helpful.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I spent an awful lot of time and continue to go back and forth to Ireland. And one of the things that strikes me is, and there's a push to do this here, but it's being resisted. And that is, when you come out of the academy, first of all, you've got a degree. If you're already going to a degree, you can go after an advanced degree while you're in the academy. But what becomes important is that you are there, you are sworn, you are sent back. You go back into the community. You are asked questions along the way that you have to write and reflect, and the power of reflection. We don't ever, in policing, we're not doing a lot of reflecting. Maybe you are as a police chief. Maybe you are as a deputy. But most of the time, it's like next call, next call, next call. And you never have time to step back. Well, this power of reflection is very valuable. In fact, I know it would never take shape here. But in essence, in Ireland and in cases in the UK, you're on probation for 3 years. You don't prove prove yourself until you've done the academy, you've had experience, you go back to the academy, you discuss the things you did, what would you do better, how would you handle it, how did Joey handle it, rather than it's those kinds of things. Your head is shaking.
Well, because I work with the Swedes, and that's what the Swedes do, the same thing.
Yeah, it's crazy. And this
three
is
years before you're on your own.
Right, and this is the thing that is so much different. 20 weeks, you know, 8 weeks with an FTO, maybe a couple of them, and then you're on your own, kid, and that's it. And don't screw up within the next 8 months, because we'll whack you before you're on probation. But once you've got probation, it's like getting tenure. You're almost untouchable.
Here's a little one that I don't know if you've run into this one before, but I remember asking, I was with a Belgian police officer and a Swedish police officer, and I was telling them about policing in the U.S. and firearms and stuff, you know, and how we're trained to shoot at center mass when the shooting comes about. And I said, you know, just off the cuff, I said, you wouldn't shoot a person in the leg, would you? And they went, yeah, of course. And then the Belgian guy said, yeah, of course. Why would you have to kill him? So we're living in this assumption for 30, 40 years that shooting at center mass is the best thing to do. I'm not saying it isn't. And I'm not saying it wasn't put in there to bring some type of order to what we're doing. But there are other people that do things differently, and they're not picking up dead bodies after. I think you work overseas, so you know what I'm talking about.
I do. There's a lot we can learn. And there's a lot we can learn from each other. So as we get to the end, Ed, what is on your bucket list? What's on your to-do list? You know, what keeps you going? You've been retired for a while like me, but you keep plugging away and you keep trying to have some impact on the profession that you know and love.
I love the profession. Mm-hmm. That's what keeps me going. Mm-hmm. I think we can do a lot better. I really do. Policing in the United States in its present form is only 200 years old. Go back to London, Metropolitan Police, and all those things that came about. And if you look at it from a historical point of view, that's a speck of dust. Yeah. Why would we think after 200 years that we know everything? So that to me makes rich, fertile ground to think about how we could do things differently. Bring in what you said about education to enhance our knowledge and look at different ways of doing things. And I want to be contributing as long as I can.
If you had a chance to sit down with somebody who is now passed, who might that be? Whose brain would you like to pick?
I guess you're talking about anyone.
Yes. Yes.
Well, Abraham Lincoln is my hero.
You're not the first. Why?
Because he was a human being and he made tons of mistakes, but he learned from his mistakes. You used the word reflected, and he reflected, and he was always a work in progress. And I think when we get to the point when we think we know it all, that's when we really slip up. You know, admire people that can be humble, can admit when they make a mistake and move on. And that empowers others.
So let's go back to the policing. When you do that, I think so many agencies, when someone makes a mistake, it's very rarely a fatal mistake, but we become so punitive that it really shuts people off. You've had that experience, I'm sure, where get out of the car without a hat and you've got some old timer who says that's a violation and I'm going to write you up and I'm going to give you a day off or whatever it is. What does that do to empower people or to cause people to reflect? It seems to me that's a learning opportunity rather than something that has to be punitive. So how do we change that mindset?
Well, I think the old keep your hat on and stuff like that, that was when I first came on the job. There was more of that. As I went on, there's a saying that when we meet people, we look for ourselves and others. When I got on the job, there was a group of police officers who were like-minded like myself, and we reinforced each other and we did great police work. And a lot of times, a lot of the people that we worked with would look at us like, why are you wasting your time doing all that work? You know, you're not going to get a raise. But it's just a matter of you're doing it because you signed up to do it. You took an oath to do it. And you want to do the right thing, and you find peers that support you, and you flourish.
Sounds to me like that's internal pride, that you do it because it's the right thing to do. You do it because you want to earn respect, because you want to respect other people, that you want to have a relationship. When you're on a beat and you're just driving by, you're walking by, and the most you're doing is waving instead of sitting, talking, getting to know people, that's, in my estimation, that's how policing can advance, by knowing those people, by showing them the human side of the police officer. Even though you're in uniform and you represent the institution, government, power, authority, we're still all human beings at our roots. You have the last word.
I think the last word for me is strive for humility. I think there's so much of this stuff going on out there about demonizing and attacking and all this other stuff. And I've found that humility, being humble, talking about my mistakes, encouraging others is probably a very powerful thing that helps people to let down the barrier and be open to learning and reflecting.
I gave you the last word, but I'll say one thing that triggers in my mind. My three favorite words that I pass on to young people is to be humble, be candid, and be curious. And if that happens, then you don't get that R of superiority. So we've been talking with Ed Cronin, the former chief of police, both in Gardner, Massachusetts, and Fitchburg, and he is the author of Just Policing, My Journey to Police Reform. Ed, how can people get in touch with you?
My email address is ed@justpolicing.org, and my website, where you can get the book if you like, is www.justpolicing.org.
Great. Well, thank you so much. Another episode is in the books. We've had the pleasure of talking with Ed out in central Massachusetts. Ed, thank you so much for your time, your energy, and your input.
Thank you. This was an honor. Thank you so much.
No problem. Thanks. We'll see you in the next episode. Hey, everybody, a few things before you leave. First, thanks for listening. I'm so gratified to see the downloads rising in the last few months, not only from the U.S., but from across the globe. It's surprising and humbling to find students, colleagues, and practitioners listening. We have a growing number of listeners in Canada, Ireland, England, Northern Ireland, Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Germany, and Colombia. We appreciate your time and energy and welcome feedback. Please feel free to reach out to me by email at copdoc.podcast@gmail.com.
Thanks for listening to the Cop Doc Podcast with Dr. Steve Morreale. Steve is a retired law enforcement practitioner and manager turned academic and scholar from Worcester State University. Please tune into the Cop Doc Podcast for regular episodes of interviews with thought leaders in policing.